I wanted to bring a drink up here, but I just keep going back to nothing. I'll do a couple more jokes, guys, and then bring up your head. Bring up Robert. How's the coffee, man?
You know, it's a fucking killer show when you can hear people opening up their sugar packets. I'm sending this tape to America's Got Talent.
With one stroke of the pen, I tune in to your satellite radio or FM station. I've been patiently waiting to weigh in. Been under construction for 2 years, but now it's by that time I double dutch my way in. Left foot, right foot, stepping over fighters. It's like the game is haunted, cause there's so many ghostwriters. Me see all my life, a whistle blow that makes it endless. Straight rider like a biker on a chopper with a hit list. Witness the nigga that spit that vicious pit bull attack shit when it comes to this rap shit. Daddy Mac Sacks.
Cause I'm not the one, no I'm not the one.
Real quick, here's some dates, guys. I'll be at the Liberty Funny Bone this week, April 28th through the 30th. That's Thursday through Saturday at the Liberty Funny Bone in Middletown, Ohio, and or Westchester, Ohio, I should say. And then May 1st, Sunday, I'll be at the Columbus Funny Bone. Off for the week of Mother's Day, and then May 11th and 12th, I'll be in New Mexico. On the 11th, at the Inn of the Mountain Gods. On the 12th, Santa Ana Star Casino. Hope you can come out for that. Then you'll see me Friday, May 20th at Rock on the Range in Columbus, Ohio. A huge rock concert. There's a comedy tent. I'll be there with my best good friend, Jay Snyder. Jay Moore will be headlining. I hope you guys can come out to that. I hope you got your tickets already because I guess they sell out in a couple hours. Then the last week of May, I'll be at Hartford, Connecticut, the 26th through the 29th at the Funny Bone there. So hope you guys can make it and stay tuned for the rest of the episode.
Oh, now come on, look. The thing is, I'm happy. I'm fit to do this. I just don't see the romance in it.
But you got it, Captain Greenlaw. You do, believe me. I see them come and go. The day I laid eyes on you, I said to myself, she's going to be a good one. You can't be good unless you love it. Fog's just lifting. Throw off your bow line, throw off your stern. You head out the South Channel, past Rocky Neck, 10-pound island, past Niles Pond, where I skated as a kid. You blow your air horn and you throw a wave to the lighthouse keeper's kid on Thatcher Island. And the birds show up. Blackbacks and herring gulls, big dump ducks. The sun hits you. Head north, open up to 12. Steaming now. The guys are busy. You're in charge. You know what? You're a goddamn sword boat captain. Is there anything better in the world?
Hey guys, welcome back to Totally Unrelated. I'm your host, Adrian Cosby. Sorry we're a day late here, but I had to wait to get the awesome interview that I got last night, and I'm posting it first thing this morning. So, did you like the clip I just played from Perfect Storm? That's George Clooney's monologue. It's about going to work, if you missed the subtlety. It reminds me of when I have to get up early to go on like an 8-hour road trip or head to the airport or whatever. It just brings up all these different memories, driving past places that I remember. And it's pleasurable. The drive to work is always pleasurable for me because I'm going to do something that I love. And so my only wish for you is that you are also currently on your way to doing something that you love. Very special guests on the show today, Joe List and Tom Dustin from Boston, came through Dayton. We sat down in the green room at the Funny Bone and talked for about an hour. And then after that, we headed over to the Hookah Lounge where Joe did another set. And the feeling I'm left with after the interview with Joe List is that this guy is always working. He's always working it out. He seems to almost always be somewhat deep in thought. I think he would probably discount that in some way, shape, or form. So it seems to sort of be his default method. But super sweet guy, super nice, super funny. Couldn't even see the moves coming. He has his own podcast with Mark Norman called Tuesdays with Stories. And I highly encourage you to check it out. I get it through Stitcher. I assume it's also on iTunes. And there's also a website for Tuesday with Stories. Check it out. And I hope you enjoy this episode. Tom Dustin, one of my best friends from Boston. I say best friends from Boston because I only have a couple friends from Boston. But I met Tom when I first started doing comedy. And he's a kind of a ball buster, but a super nice guy. Love it every time he comes to town. And I've been wanting to have him on the podcast for a long time. So Tom's the one with the thick Boston accent. And Joe is the one with the lesser Boston accent. I hope you guys enjoy this. Stay totally unrelated. Okay, well, we're sitting here. Joe List, Tom Dustin. Tom Dustin, Boston comedian. Joe, I don't even know.
Joe's Boston, too.
He's Joe's Boston.
Got in Boston before me.
What's funny is when I listen to Joe's podcast, I hear the Boston come out sometimes, but it's usually like when they're riffing on something.
Yeah, if I get worked up or if I'm talking real fast.
Are you originally from Boston?
I grew up about 35 minutes south of Boston.
How thick are the accents in your town related to Boston?
I think the kids, when I grew up, going back now, they all have thick accents now. So I don't know if they developed over time. I don't know. But my parents, my father has an accent. My mother doesn't.
What do they do for a living?
My dad works at a hospital. He's the head of purchasing at a hospital. And my mother is like a secretary-ish person. Very middle class, I would say.
Right.
Lower middle class. I found out recently.
So, can you dial in a Boston accent?
A little bit, but I've never had an accent like Tom does.
Right.
Where you grow up. Like the people that have the strongest accents in Boston don't grow up in Boston proper. You grow up just north or just south in those kind of blue collar neighborhoods, just north or south of the city, is where the accent's typically the strongest, I think.
So in the higher income neighborhoods of Boston, are the accents less prevalent?
I would say so.
Maybe, but I think
that's Brookline and Brighton Brookline and Newton.
Yeah, I guess so, but I think only
Louis C.K.'s from Newton.
Interesting.
So he doesn't really have a Boston accent at all.
You wouldn't hear that.
But he moved there when he was 8, though, so he had some time before then.
So what's the formative accent year, do you think? Like, if you moved to Boston when you're, like, in what grade would you think it would catch on?
I don't know.
When you start talking.
Yeah, I think it's young and who you're at. It's not from your family, which is interesting. It's from the kids you grew up with.
True, because that's more important to relate to your friends than it is to your parents.
Like, it's interesting. My girlfriend, or my fiance, I should say, like, her father is South African, her mother is English, but she has no accent because she grew up in America. So it's interesting. But, like, I still have weird things when I put R's in words that don't belong, like vodka and
saw it.
I say that, and I can't not do that. When I was drinking, it would start to come out because you're kind of more. And when I go home, I'll have more of an accent. I'll come back with more of an accent.
But I think that happens with anyone with an accent. Once you leave your home, once you return and you're around your friends, it's just you absorb that. You're back into it.
And a lot of times the comedy, you try to, like, I'm just trying to enunciate.
Right.
And that's the thing I would think with a lot of these. I think there's a lot of probably upper class people in Boston that might have accents, but then they go to fucking Harvard or whatever, and they don't want to sound like that.
Right.
Some people make an effort to lose the Boston
accent.
That's
what I was going
to
ask.
Or, you know, if you're from, I guess, an upper class family, your parents would do that to you and be like, no, don't speak like that.
Right, right. I suppose so. But I remember saying bathroom for a long time until high school. People would start making fun of me for saying bathroom. And I had to consciously changed to saying bathroom. I remember having like an early bit. I was like in 13 or 14. I was like, isn't it funny? I was like, you know, you kind of write jokes, and I'd be like, isn't it funny you take a bath in the bathroom? And then everyone was like this, what the fuck are you? Who bathroom? Are you crazy? But my whole family says bathroom when I go home.
Remember EJ used to have a joke?
Yeah, yeah.
EJ used to have a joke along that line. This guy, EJ Murphy, a great friend of ours from when we were younger, and he used to do a joke about the Boston accent. He had a pretty good bit about the Boston accent.
Totally.
Because he broke it down to, not only do we not say R's, in words that have R's, we'll add R's to words that don't.
Makeup R.
But the
you have lovely red hair.
that was the interesting thing that I never, when he said it, I was like, yeah, that's right. One of the other things about the Boston accent is we'll add an extra syllable to a one syllable word, like hair.
Right.
We'll say hair. Yeah. Close the dough up.
Yeah. My uncle Dale, my grandmother would always call him Dale.
Dale.
Which is hilarious. Yeah. Which almost sounds southern in a weird way.
That's what, and that's interesting because I had a friend who, when I lived in North Carolina, he grew up there his whole life, and his family was very southern in terms of, like, because North Carolina has the whole gamut of accents of southern, like aristocrat southern. Right. I do declare, but like he was very.
I do declare, I don't want that man with a vagina in my bathroom.
His family was very
bathroom.
much more Larry the Cable Guy, you know, kind of sensibility, but he had a complete northerner's, what I would call a Berlitz language tape enunciation ability. And I said, where did you develop that? And he said, I just realized when I was about a sophomore in high school that the people that talked like the people from my family had less important jobs than the people that talked like the people I saw on TV.
Right.
And so I just made a conscious effort to kind of work my way out of it. Now, he has not excelled past, you know, it's not like he's a newscaster or a college developed career, but it is interesting to me that some people work their way out of an accent.
So if you go to a broadcast school, that's the first thing they make you do.
They'll break you, yeah.
That's what's amazing about those old-time guys who do have that. Like, Will McDonough in Boston had the thickest accent. He was like a WCBS, but he was like 75 years old, so it was like an old-school thing where, like, back then, they'd be like, yeah, just go talk.
Yeah, yeah.
But nowadays, you're not going to see anybody with any kind of accent. Maybe a color person.
Right.
That's the sports broadcaster.
Right.
Maybe
not to be confused.
One of these colored folks.
Well, not with the coloreds.
Like a color commentator. They're an ex-athlete and they just want that. But yeah, there's not going to be a play-by-play guy with an accent anymore.
The best example of that is the blooper reel of the guy who, like a black southern guy who's doing a remote on the side of a country road and a bug flies in his mouth.
Oh, I've seen that.
Yeah, it was like on Tosh.0 or something like that. He's like, I'm standing here on the side of a country road. What the fuck just happened? Motherfucker, goddamn bug flying in my mouth. They got these motherfuckers out of here. It literally was a complete character change.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm fascinated by that because when I hang out with Tom, and I've known Tom since I started doing comedy. I think I met him my first year in comedy. And the Boston accent, when I worked in construction, anybody that had a Boston or any Massachusetts or any kind of like upper northern, it was a Yankee. That went in front of their name. So it was like Yankee Dave, Yankee Steve.
Right.
And I would always find myself emulating accents regardless of the
Australian. Was there a Yankee Dick?
No.
Yankee Dick.
That seems like I just get truncated to Yank Dick. There is now. I mean, we can talk about your boyfriend.
Yankee Dick.
Do you find this, Tom, people emulating your accent?
When I show up to a club, typically by the end of the week, there's a couple of people that, like, I'll be hanging out with a dude and his girlfriend, I don't even notice it when they do it, but it'll usually be the girlfriend being like, why are you talking like that? And it's because I think they some people just pick it up.
Yeah.
But I...
it's a personality trait.
I'd say there's fucking eight or ten comedians in 8 or 10 different towns across the country that all do a Tom Dustin impression. And it's always the worst fucking...
Oh, yeah, for sure. It's not because any impression...
And none of them sounds like me, to me.
Well, no, for sure. I would agree. But I think that people that latch onto impressions are fascinated by it. You know, they say, like, imitation is the closest...
Well, even when we went to the Pearl Jam concert last night, and I was standing outside smoking a cigarette, and I was talking to a couple of people, and then out of the corner of my eye, this fucking one guy goes, I'm putting out my cigarette, and the guy goes, are you having another cigarette? And I go, what, do you need one or something? He goes, no, man, I just want to continue to listen to you talk.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah,
you're like a circus freak.
Yeah,
exactly.
But I don't mind it. I don't mind it.
I think what it is with Boston for me is that there's a certain amount of conviction behind what people are saying.
Yeah.
In terms of it being fact, not just an opinion. It's like when with a right. thick Boston accent, it's like what, like, but you're saying something and there's an emotion behind right. it or something. It's something about it that just has. It'd be more magnetic than people that.
Well, are part of that is not just the accent, because there's a lot of angry. Everyone in Boston is angry. So there's also that anger. When you say something fucking angrily, it sounds like I really thought a lot about this right, fucking right, thing. Right. Which is how people just talk.
Yeah, right.
In New England.
What are people in New England so angry about?
The weather, the baseball team. But that's changing now. The sports are different. Now there's going to be a whole generation of people that grow up.
With winners.
Which is very, which I feel like will have an actual like sociological
that will have
effect.
A social effect.
Like sure. there's kids that are 15 that have seen 9 championships. It's bananas. We were all losers.
Mm. Our
we
entire lives.
That was our personality.
Right, waiting
the fucking
for
losers.
It to
the Pats. Everything.
Right.
Yeah.
Everybody.
The dogs. The fucking.
And yeah, the weather. But also, there's also a lot of Irish people on top of each other. It's very like. Thickly settled, whatever that is.
Yeah.
Like Massachusetts, eastern Massachusetts is like the most what's that word? When it's all put together,
densely
populated area in the country, along with New York.
No, like so, there's not like sprawling.
There's no open spaces really in eastern Mass. So everyone's living on.
That's
top
why
of
it's
each other.
Like when you come out to the Midwest and stuff. Stuff is so spread out, and you don't see tall buildings. Like we have to build everything up
right.
or into the earth. We
right.
have to. Tunnel it or build it straight up because we don't have the room.
Yeah, the weather sucks. And then there's also just a lot of generally...
there's some shitbag people, but some of the best people... I think the best people in the country live in the Northeast.
Yeah, the best people I've ever met, you know. But that's my, you know...
No, yeah, no bias. No bias.
Really.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I love Ohio. I mean, I was born
I love Ohio, too. My family lived in Ohio for a little bit.
What part?
Yeah, they live here in Dayton.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, my mother lived in Dayton. All of them. Well, Dale didn't, obviously. They lived in Dayton.
I never knew that.
Yeah, for like 7 years.
We no
family
shit.
Over here. Yeah, my mother lived here from like third grade to ninth grade.
Wow.
Yeah.
Small world.
Yeah, pretty crazy.
So we'll talk about this. This is less topical. One of the first things I noticed, I found out about Joe List from Tom Dustin.
He's my hype man.
I am
all over the country.
It's always been my dream to quit comedy and manage Joe.
That sounds like a fucking high aspiration. But I remember the first time I met Tom, he said, "You're the guy." I just watched a video. He said, "You're the guy that said you started telling people you were a comic before you started doing comedy." And
uh-oh.
I was like,
"Oh, this is gonna get real."
Yeah, and that's kind of where I was.
You did that?
Yeah, yeah. We were talking, because I think Jared was doing a documentary. I don't know if it'll ever get completed, but...
oh, I know the one. Yeah, yeah.
And
I've seen clips of it.
For me, telling people I was a comic before I started really being a comic was...
wait, when did you start?
Well, that's a question, because we talked about this at the time, which was like the first time I did an open mic versus when I started doing comedy. So it's like the first open mic was a year and a half from when I started doing comedy.
That doesn't make any sense to me at all.
So I did an open mic, and I was like, okay, that was great, but I don't think this is for me.
I'm in.
Yeah, that happened. I feel like almost the majority of comics I know... I feel very pretentious holding this pen.
what are you, John McCain?
The majority of comics I know have did one show and then didn't do it for a long time. You had that. Didn't you do a
That's
show
what he
and
said.
Then
not
do
no,
it?
No, my start was I did one show at the Vault, not the Vault, the Chops Lounge.
Right.
Larry Lee Lewis killed my first time. And I was like, this is awesome.
Yeah.
I had no idea you could do the same jokes.
Yeah.
That's another common thing.
That's a very common thing.
I did that too. Same thing. Every week I would come back. But when you're only doing, when you start, a lot of times you're just doing one open mics. You're doing the same room.
Right.
Yeah. So now, 20 years later, if I go to the same room, I'm like, shit, it's the same thing. I got to do different jokes.
Right.
So essentially, we had it right.
Yeah.
Right.
But you're not supposed to do that.
Yeah, I had it right. I knew 5 minutes, ate it so bad, I think I cried. And then quit. I ate it so bad, I quit for an entire year. And then the following year, I was like, hey, I'm going to try to do this again. And that's when I actually... That was 2002.
What did you do in the year... What were you doing in that year prior, though? Like, in the year between when you took off?
Nothing. I mean, I think I was working for a limousine company or something. Yeah, not... I wasn't doing anything special.
No entertainment-based?
I might have been working for a beer company, and the closest thing I could come to entertainment was that we'd do promotions where I'd hire a couple of t-shirt girls and get close. Drunk. Yeah. And you know, occasionally you'd have to be on a mic, you know, telling, you know, promotional shit or whatever.
That was pretty much it for me, which was like I did one, and then I went back the next week with brand new shit, which I didn't, like, I didn't know that, like, writing jokes was a real thing. I felt like, I was like, I'm just funny with in conversation, and I went up like literally 3 days before I was going to get married with my bachelor party. Like my, all my these guys just want to go and fucking see strippers and gamble and shit.
Oh no, come watch me do comedy jokes.
It was the most miserable experience of my life, and it wasn't till like a year and a half later when I had torn my ACL from playing soccer. Like I was playing soccer, like most comics do open mics.
Yeah,
And I was playing online poker like most comics do professional gigs.
Right.
Like 40 hours a week online poker, 30 hours a week soccer, and I was working 50 hours a week at a restaurant. So it was like no time at the end of the day. Tore my ACL, online poker became illegal the same week.
And then so they took everything from
you. And then I found an improv advertisement on Facebook, and I signed up for that class, skipped the first two classes, went to the third class where I met 7 comedians. Who were basically like, it was like the day I found my tribe.
Right.
Where I was like, I walked into a room full of strangers where it was like, suddenly I don't have to explain myself.
Yeah, that's what I always likened it to that Blind Melon video. Remember the girl with the bee?
Yeah, yeah. And five no rain? Bees.
Yeah, yeah.
So walk through that.
I mean, that's the feeling you have. There's a great in Comedians in Cars.
Yeah.
With Chris Rock and Jerry Seinfeld, they're talking about it. And they're talking about being at some big like fundraiser event with all these celebrities and like, you know, rich people, and then Chris Rock finds Jerry and goes, comedian.
Yeah.
And that's how you always feel. I mean, I feel that way 100% of the time. That feeling of like, oh my god, thank god,
somebody that I can fucking latch on to.
But it felt like that even at the very beginning, because you're like, how, you didn't know them and you hadn't been through the experience of being a comedian, but the idea of like, oh, these people are the funniest people and they're trying to be comedians was neat.
It's funny because now sometimes I'll be, one time I was at a bachelor party for a guy I didn't know very well, but I found the comedians in that group and none of them were comedians. But it was almost like...
Oh, right. I see what you're saying.
You know what I mean? And yeah. It was like one of those things where, and they were like, well, what do you do? And I was like, I'm a comedian. And they're like, really? And I was like, and you know, like after a while, and like one of the things that I could say to somebody that would have them be... that I know would like touch them and have them be moved was like, if I brought you around my friends, they wouldn't know you weren't a comedian.
Right, right. Oh, that's awesome.
Are you serious?
Right.
And it's one of those things where it's like funny in a group is where we all kind of start, I think.
Yeah. But everyone can be funny.
Not everyone, but it's not the same thing. It's not the same thing as doing it on stage for strangers. That's right. For sure.
Well, that's what's, oh shit, I lost my thought. Fuck me in the asshole. God damn it.
Was that your thought?
Yeah, yeah. I would like for one of you to fuck me in the asshole.
How long have you been on the road? How long have you been doing comedy?
I mean, I started in 2016, 16 years. And
did you start, like, from your first open mic to, like, this is what I do now?
Yeah, well, I mean, my first year I did, like, 55 shows. I just did every Wednesday. I didn't know.
Right, right, right.
I'm still like that mentally. I never have enough, what do you call it? Goals or yeah, I was just like, all right, I'm doing comedy once a week, and then someone was like, well, there's a show on Sunday, you could do that show as well. And I was like, oh, it never occurred to me to be like, well, I could do a show every night. I was just doing the one show, and I was like, I'm doing it.
Chops Lounge,
yeah, which is still the truest open mic I've ever seen. Yeah, really? Like homeless people and drug addicts on the show.
What
it's still.
So what's
still
the what's way. The opposite of Chops Lounge?
What as far as.
As far as an open mic would be, like you said, it's the truest.
Like, literally, they would just keep putting people up. Like,
there's no,
like, so, people would come off the streets and, like, a homeless guy would be like, I'm going to go. They'd be like, yeah, sign your name. And that's what you had to sign your name, and then that was it.
That was the only,
there was no, like, no ID. Email me. Well, email didn't.
Yeah, send me a video.
But nobody was like, I guess it did exist, actually. But yeah, there was no, like, you got to know somebody. There's no name in the hat. We only have 20 people, and that's it.
Right.
The list would just keep getting longer. It would go fucking all night. And, like, there'd be 40 comics on, and of that, 4 of them are still doing comedy. It was a bunch of fucking lunatics. Literally, there's brawls in the street. I remember two guys fighting in the street. Fucking Teddy Bergeron and like another dude, and then Coomer would videotape the audience, which was real crazy. It was real wild. And then who was the guy? Fouts, the guy that would. The fuck was his name? He was Will Fouch. Will Fouch.
Yeah, he kept changing his name because he would burn his bridge at a place and then just change his name
so he could get and back show up.
He was a weird line of like, is this guy the next Andy Kaufman? Is he a genius or is he fucking out of his mind?
But isn't that
I think
common?
It was more the latter.
Yeah. That's but there was something.
He would do it a funny thing occasionally, but he would go up like wearing a sheet and like rock around the back of the wall like he was a ghost. I remember weird shit.
I find that comedy open mics are the lowest form of entry to entertainment in terms of.
Of course, yeah.
If you were going to do a musical open mic, they would require you to sing.
Yeah, you have to play an instrument.
Right, but you could do a comedy open mic with your guitar. You could do slam poetry at a comedy open mic. Nobody's going to be like, no, you can't get on the list at an open mic for comedy.
Well, because it's only a mic. Right. The mic is open.
Right.
That's what comedy is. So it's, yeah, it's definitely
I feel like a poetry open mic, though, would be way more. I've never done one, but I feel like that would be one of the highest levels of scrutiny.
No, a poetry open mic is easiest thing in the world. It's essentially a comedy open mic without punchline required.
Right.
Like, you don't have to be funny.
Right.
I kind of feel like they would spot the crazy first, though. Whereas in comedy,
anyone that goes to
even
a poetry fucking thing is just ready to clap for whatever poor shit comes out of your way.
Yeah, you snap there.
Do you snap it?
Yeah. I'm not into the poetry scene.
I'm not either. I think that's more for like.
It's comedy without punchlines to me. That's
right.
I think a poetry open mic is closer to a rap open mic.
Right.
Do they have rap open mics?
Yeah, and I've seen them.
Is there one tonight?
Not that we can get on. But I've seen them in Dayton, and what's funny is I drove by one, and it was like looking at from the outside looking in, it looked exactly like a comedy open mic.
Yeah.
It was guys outside smoking cigarettes and hanging out, you know, and inside there was a small crowd.
Right.
And people.
I have been to one of those, actually. I've been to a rap battle, open battle, right? Yeah, whatever. Freestyle dance off thing. Whatever.
Pants off, dance off.
Pants off, dance off.
How long till you got your first paid work?
I think a couple of years, a year and a half, 2 years.
Because it only took Steve Max 7 months.
Oh, wow.
And it takes most comics 5 years.
Yeah, I mean, I did a couple, but I wasn't like making consistent money. I did like this guy, Ed Regal, had like a bar show. And I remember being strange that he handed me $50.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember being like, this guy's a fucking weirdo. And I remember saying, oh, no, that's okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he gave me a speech that I still think about, when he's like, this is a long haul and a terrible business. So take any money that anyone ever offers you ever.
I had a similar
just
situation.
Just go, nah, I don't need that. Just go, yes, thank you. Appreciate it.
I had a similar situation with Mike Gardner trying to give me money for a show that I didn't feel like was, like, I knew the, like, I counted the people in the audience. And I knew the ticket prices, and I was like, this is
yeah, but with
money.
A guy like that, you just take the
you
money.
Take the money, right? And I didn't know that at the time, especially with a guy like that.
Yeah, because the rest of the time, he's taking the money from you.
Right, but it is funny to get paid for something like that.
Yeah, it still feels weird sometimes.
Yeah.
You get the check, and you're like, well, that was crazy.
Yeah.
It reminds me of Mitch Fatel has a joke about women's tennis, and he's like, when you realize I could see their underwear, and he's like, nobody say anything. That's how I feel about comedy, where you're like, they hand you a check and you're like, nobody say shit.
Yeah, right.
Just take it, be like quiet.
But there is, I've had that weird feeling where I fucking eat it.
Yeah.
And then the person's like, alright, so here's what we agreed on, and
right.
I'm like,
oh. Right.
Yeah. And I feel like I learned that from Tom, because the first time I ever got it was the first time I ever got paid after eating a dick. And it was like eating a dick in front of my peers.
And then it became real easy for you.
And then going to the person with your hand out.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
But
and it was
them,
one of those things, it's
know.
Like, if you don't, then you open the door to always not.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like if I said, I'm sorry, I shit the bed. When in reality, it was probably more the audience than it was me. But it's like if you walk up there and you're like, listen, this one's on me, sorry, then that becomes an option in the future.
Yeah, no, you did the job.
Right.
The crowd sucked. Fuck them. That's what I say. They should be giving you money.
At what level do you differentiate between like fuck the crowd and what the fuck did I do?
I don't know. I think It depends on the level of the comic, I guess, but I think it's almost 100% of the time it's the crowd. Because I'm doing jokes that worked.
Right. And
these jokes, I play recordings.
Right.
These jokes work. I have fucking W-2s. I've been on TV. This joke works. You stink.
Do you find it it's being them. Like, do you ever have a situation where the guy, where your feature act does better? Because you're headlining for how long now? Like, more so than featuring for like maybe 2 years now?
A couple years, yeah.
Yeah. So then, how's that transition been from featuring? Because I just had my first, like...
Yeah, I think what he's trying to get out is, what's it been like between, hey, you were way better than the headliner, to...
Now you're the headliner.
Well, that's the thing. I featured for so long, longer than most people do. So it's... I was 12 years in. I mean, I had done Letterman before I started headlining.
I think I have the record now.
Wow.
So, I was headlining... I've been doing comedy for fucking 12 years and been on TV, so it wasn't can I do this time?
It wasn't like you felt like you got there early to the party.
No, I got there real, real late.
Yeah.
And I was opening for peers and people that are doing comedy a lot less than me. So,
yeah.
But it's been fucking wonderful. It's wonderful. It's much better. You get paid much better and you're treated better. And
how much of the...
It's harder.
The acceptance of, like, we want you to headline, Joe, how much of, like, them telling you they want you to headline, how much did that affect your act as far as being better? Because they're, like, when I found that once I got past this troop, I had this huge, like, wellspring of confidence, like, I had been validated, which made my show better.
I looked at it as he just had an off day, bad judgment.
Right, that's kind of where I felt, but I felt like I didn't want to drop the ball. So...
No, I don't know. Yeah, I guess it gives you some amount of confidence. Sometimes it makes you less confident, though, because you middle for so long. You're like, oh, this is easy. And then you got to go headline. You're like, oh, shit.
Yeah, this is hard.
It's more nerve-wracking than it is a confidence boost, I think. But, I definitely think there's a lot of validations. But I think everything I've ever done in my career, I was way over-qualified because it took much longer.
By the time
longer.
You got there.
Yeah. Like, I, you know...
But that's better. I think that's smarter than being unprepared, unready. Like, a lot of times, people are thrust into celebrity or headlining clubs shouldn't be.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Like, Last Comic Standing is a perfect example. Some people make it real far on that show, but only have a feature set.
Of course, yeah. It happens all the time.
If a
feature set.
Yeah, it happens all the time. And then they end up going off to something else, and they'll be, like, red carpet people on MTV or whatever the fuck.
Right.
So, yeah, I definitely... wouldn't change anything, but I wanted to kill myself for a long time.
Yeah.
Not literally, but I was bummed out.
It's an interesting dimension for comedy because it's truly an apprenticeship when you start in that you have to seek out the punishment.
It's an apprenticeship without any fucking master.
It all goes away when you stop going to work for it.
You're apprenticing under no one.
Yeah, it's very strange. That's what's so crazy about comedy. It's a brutal art form and a brutal business.
Yeah.
Separately. They're both nightmares. To come up with material that strangers are going to laugh at and then to deal with getting booked and all the other shit.
Yeah, and it's all
new. It sucks.
New.
I wouldn't recommend it for anybody.
And that's the one thing. That's the one thing. People say, like, I went to the Verizon store today and I could tell instantly the guy that was helping me was the funny guy at work.
Right.
You know, and he's like, I've never met a comedian before, you know, like, where do you perform? I was like, and it was right by the Columbus Funny Bone.
Do you go in every store you go in, you're like, hi, I'm a comedian?
See, I've never told anybody. <that's>
I literally, in like probably the last
how
year,
did that come up at the Verizon's? Hey, I'm looking at this iPhone 6 Plus. Well, I'm a comedian.
So he says, I see you don't have any employee discounts on your phone. And he said, where do you work? And I said, the Funny Bone. Because I'm thinking, like, if anybody's got a Verizon discount, it's going to be the Funny Bone chain, right? So that's like the closest thing.
That's not bad.
And so he says, are you a comedian? And then I say, yes. But I don't, like, at that point, I don't want to say I'm a dishwasher.
Right.
But at that, and he's like, well, we don't have any discounts for them. But then he starts asking me questions about being a comedian or whatever. But I realized it's one of those things, the lack of how you get started is what kept me out of it the longest. You know what I mean? It's like until you meet another comedian.
Yeah, I didn't even know that it was a thing you could do.
I went to the newspaper. old school.
That's how I got started.
It was like the paper.
I think I did.
I was like, where's the show?
Boston All Phoenix.
Right. Yeah, and then I remember walking by Fenway. I saw the sign for Chops on the fucking
So you had thing. The idea organically.
That's how I just got into comedy.
It's Wednesday open mic.
I wandered into it by accident.
Okay.
I think you were there.
Probably.
I walked in. Kuma was definitely there.
Yeah.
I walked in. It was me and Leva 2000 and his slut girlfriend at the time.
Yeah, he was doing stand-up.
Not then. Right. What happened was we had come from a... I was in the beer industry. And we had come from a thing. I was doing a promotion at a VIP thing on Lansdowne Street. It was Nickelback was playing. And we just walked out.
Yikes.
We walked out of Nickelback. And we were like, let's find a drink. And then we saw there was a little lounge at this little hotel. We were walking by it. Hey, let's check this place out. And we saw a little sign that said, free comedy tonight. We're like, this is the best! I love comedy. So we sat in the audience and watched all these guys do 5 minutes. And some of them stunk. And some of them were great. But at the time, we didn't know the fucking difference. We were just thrilled that someone was trying to do comedy in front of us for free.
Right.
And I was like, I remember leaning over to someone and being like, how does this work? You just sign up and you can come here and do this? And they're like, yeah, that's all.
Right.
That can't be the key to the comedy city.
Where do you get registered, though? Right. You got to get a license, right?
Yeah,
it's strange. And I love the Ellis Seinfeld thing. We said, comedians, the only job in the world where the first time you ever do it, you're introduced as that thing.
That's right. That's the
here comes a comedian.
Yeah.
And you're like, I'm a comedian.
Yeah, you're like, you want to be a pirate? Put the patch on, you're a fucking pirate.
Yeah, you never go, you're the surgeon.
Yeah.
And that's the other great Seinfeldism is you just have to keep doing it until you figure it out, which would no one would ever just give a scalpel to a guy and be like, all right, just keep cutting until his brain works. And you're like, oh, shit.
This guy's great. He's been helped a lot of people, except for the ones that died. Yeah, that's weird about comedy for sure. And I think that's what the difference between like me doing my first couple open mics versus meeting comedians, understanding the idea behind it. Because it was literally like meeting comedians and watching the documentary I Am Comic at around the same time that had me realize like, oh, if this is what I'm going to do, it's all pain. It's all misery.
I don't know.
Well, here's the thing though about that is that
I think it's pretty awesome. I don't have to fucking shovel anything.
I'll say this. When the other thing that I...
car out to get to the gig.
There it is.
I don't have a license.
Well, not anymore. And that was me being in Boston. Not
I heard
anymore.
It.
All from Tom.
Yeah.
But I think... Fuck, I lost my train of thought. What were we talking about right before that?
Pain was painful.
Painful.
Yeah.
When I first started playing soccer in high school, I went to conditioning for the first day and ran harder and longer than I'd ever run. The next day, my muscles hurt in a way that I'd never felt before.
Yeah.
That was literally like the first 6 weeks of the season. And then I went out and the varsity goalie had gotten hurt. I'm a freshman. I get to start the first official game of the year. We should have won 4-2. We end up tying 4-4, and I'm in tears. It's very painful. But by the time I'm a senior, I've got a full ride scholarship. First team all Dayton, first team all county. I mean, I got all these medals and stuff. It was very easy at that point. So I think that like anything that's worth having should be kind of painful in the beginning to appreciate the...
You used to have a thing that you... I have an old notebook that you one day, I think, grabbed my notebook at the vault and you wrote a thing about life is hard. Or no, life is easy. But dying is easy.
That's a old Peter O'Toole. Dying is easy. Comedy is hard.
Yeah.
That's a Peter O'Toole quote. Yeah, yeah. Well, that's fun.
I have another
great quote, I think, is Peter O'Toole. He said, it's easy to pretend to be serious, but you can't pretend to be funny, which I always love.
That's
wow.
That's a great one.
That's an interesting concept.
You can't fake funny.
I don't know. I know a bunch of guys that do it.
That's true, I guess.
On some level. Talk to me about sobriety and how that affected your comedy or how comedy affected your sobriety.
It definitely helped my comedy career and comedy, I guess, as well.
How unsober were you before you went to sobriety?
I mean, I was a drunk. I was a
belligerent? functioning alcoholic?
I mean, I was functioning, I suppose. I mean, I went to gigs and stuff, and I functioned. Yeah, I was functioning, certainly. I missed a couple shows, but I was functioning, but I was drunk. I was always drunk or hungover 100% of the time.
And then what was the wake up?
Shit in a shoe.
I had a bunch. I shit in a girl's shoe on a first date and pissed on a rug.
I thought that was a Fletch joke.
I flew across the country to a gig with shit all over my pants and my leg. But then I kept drinking for like 3 more years. I remember landing, doing the gig with shit on my pants and on my leg, and literally having the thought, I better not drink tonight. I should take a night off. And then a couple hours later going, well, I'm going to drink again, so why don't I just drink tonight?
Right.
I drank the night that I shit on my legs and in this girl's shoe. But then I kept going, and then I got herpes, which was a big one, where I was like, I'm going to quit drinking, and I didn't. And then, then I just knew. I mean, I knew that I needed to quit drinking from the time I was 23 years old or whatever. You start realizing, like, oh, this isn't how people drink. You can't just drink like this. This is crazy.
And, like, I remember, when we were younger and both, when he was drinking, we were both drinking really hard. I still drink, but we were both drinking real hard. You'd look at, like, the guys in our comedy scene, the veteran guys, nearly none of them drank.
Right.
All the best ones that were still around, all of them had given that shit up.
Yeah, there's not a lot of people that can pull it off. Like, Attell was great as a drunk. Stanhope does it. Both people, you can make an argument, how great would they be
if they weren't
doing that. There's not a lot of fucking really great, prolific comics that are fucking
wasted.
Boozing real hard. I'll tell you what helped me, too. Like, a big thing was the Bill Hicks documentary called American...
Yeah, yeah.
Something. I watched that, and there was a whole thing. He was a drunk, maniac, crazy... But we had such similar kind of stories. Like, he started when he was, I think, 14. I started when I was 18. And he was like the young, hot kid, never drank, and that was me when I started doing comedy. And everyone was like, this guy's the guy, which I felt like was happening with me a lot. Then he started to drink and party and was good, but it was just kind of stagnant and angry. And then he got sober, and then he became a genius. That hasn't happened to me yet,
I'm
hoping.
Well, I think you've always been a genius.
But thanks, buddy. I remember thinking, like, watching that documentary and going, I gotta quit. This is the opportunity. I gotta fucking quit. I could be that guy.
The turning point?
Yeah, well, that was an interesting thing because I didn't realize this, but I remember a couple of years later, I was scanning through Netflix, and I saw that movie, and I was like, oh, man, I just remember, like, that movie helped me I wanted to get sober because of that movie, and I went to watch it, and Netflix tells you the last time you watched the movie, or maybe I hadn't finished it, so it said continue watching.
Right, right.
And it had a date, and the date was the day before I quit drinking.
Wow.
So I didn't even put it together until a couple of years later when I noticed that.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I had watched that and, like, gotten sober. But I also had a thing where the last few days of me drinking, I knew I had to quit. And I was like, I gotta quit. I'm a fucking piece of shit. And I went home for, like, Christmas Eve. I blacked out Christmas Eve. Christmas Day, I was so hammered. My brother-in-law, his dad had just died, and I was making fun of him because I thought it was funny. I was like, yeah, your dad's dead. Whatever I said, I thought it was funny. And he just looked at me and was like, what's up with you? What's your deal? I'm fucking bummed out, man. And I remember feeling this, like, sinking feeling of, like, oh, man, I just hurt this guy.
Yeah.
But I thought it was funny to make a joke about his dad dying. And then I'd be like, that's when I was like, I gotta fucking...
Who's that,
off.
Soder?
No, that was Chip, my brother-in-law.
Oh.
And then I was like, I gotta quit. And then I went to... The next day, I got fucking hammered in New York. And then I went to Philadelphia, and my friend Gary Gilman gave me the you might be an alcoholic test, one of those 25 things.
Sure.
And I think it was like, if you got 15 right, you're a problem drinker. If you get 20, you're a fucking piece of shit. If you get I got like 24. And 25 was like an asterisk.
Yeah.
It was like, have you ever been hospitalized for drinking? And I was like, no. But I had gone to the hospital for being a drunk fucking idiot, falling down or whatever the fuck. So, also, there's a running gag in sober circle. If someone's giving you that test, you're an alcoholic also.
There's not
a lot of fucking non-problem drinkers that people are like, let's do a test to see if you're...
You drank 3 times? Let's do the test.
Yeah. So, yeah. And then, that was super helpful because then it opens up a whole world of,
realization. But, nobody gets help until they're... ready.
Well, it's... Well, we gotta say that it's for people that want it, not people that need it.
Sure. So did you do any programs or anything, or did you just?
Yeah, I'm in the program. I mean, I'm, you know, I don't want to get too much into it because it's supposed to be anonymous or whatever, but I don't care. I'm in the program. And,
right. But you didn't do it on your own. You didn't just, like, say, fuck it.
Well, I started, like, counting days and stuff. I didn't go to a meeting for a while because I had all these friends. Yeah, December 28th, 2012. I have a little app that tells me exactly. I can tell you the exact amount of time I've been sober if anyone's interested in it.
I'm sure.
39.99 months, 1,217 days, 29,205 hours, 3.33
years. 3.33
years?
That's three and a third. Three and a third.
Yeah, so 25,000 hours. Not so bad.
33 and a third.
That's great movie. What was the question? Yeah, so I had a lot of friends that were sober, and I remember making a list of like friends that didn't drink and stuff, and I made a list of things I enjoyed doing that don't involve drinking. But I was fortunate because I didn't drink till late. So I was like a really funny guy in high school before I drank. So I was like, I'll just go back to being that guy.
Yeah. So how hard is it not to drink now?
Not too hard. I mean, because I work a program and I've been successful in my sobriety. So I can remind myself how much I hated myself then.
Yeah.
In the 3.33 years, have you slipped at all?
No. No.
Smoked a little weed?
No, no weed, no drugs, no booze.
What was your drug activity like, if you don't mind me asking?
Not big. I liked pills, but I never had a pill guy, I would just do them leisurely. Like, I had Xanax for a while. We would take Xanax occasionally, and then my buddy was a big Vicodin guy, and to this day, I would say, even in sobriety, the best I've ever felt is 4 beers and a Vicodin, 1.5 Vicodins.
Huh.
It's fucking, if you're listening and you're not sober,
do
have
it.
A fucking Vicodin and a beer. It's bananas.
Hmm.
We always laugh at it's a pain killer. It kills the pain. But so I was a recreational. I'd smoke weed only, but I never had a weed guy. I never bought weed. If people smoke weed, I'd be like, I'll have some weed. So I was never had a drug problem.
How does your relationship line up with your sobriety?
With my girlfriend?
Yeah.
Well, she's sober, and she was sober before I was. So we dated while I was drinking, and she was sober.
Okay, so that's developed.
Do you think she just tolerated you then?
Yeah, I don't think it would have lasted. I think it lasted as long, you know, it maybe would have lasted another year or so. But it's hard, because I was, like, a couple times she'd get mad. I came home fucking blasted. With Scotty Lombardo was one example.
Yeah, really.
Fucked up. But I was never a mean drunk. I was self-hating. I would just go, you hate me, everyone hates me, fuck me. I was never like, I never hit her or fucking was like, fuck you, you cunt.
You were either the everyone hates me guy, or you were the funnest fucking person.
Yeah, I was real crazy mood drunk.
Almost
super
bipolar,
fun.
Maybe?
What's that?
Bipolar, sort of?
I don't think I'm bipolar, but I'm definitely, I guess, moody. I don't know, my girlfriend says I'm still moody, but, which is always funny to me, because I'm like, yeah, it's life, it's long.
Yeah.
I'm in a bunch of different moods. Fucking, I'm in a bad mood, I'm in a good mood.
That's why I wear this ring.
How long have you been with your girlfriend?
Jeez. 5 years almost. June will be 5 years.
And now you're engaged for how long?
September 28th. I'm good with dates.
So, like, I've been married for 6 years, going on 7 in October.
Yeah.
And so they call it, like, the 7-year...
itch.
You say without the B, that's fine.
hey.
But I wonder... For you, because I don't know, because I was with my wife for maybe 2 years before we got engaged, and then maybe a total of 9-10 years total.
Yeah.
But it's like really hit this weird space now where we know each other so well that it's almost it's past friendship, and now it's like brutal honesty. But I wonder, like, having been together for so long and then get married, I wonder if that 7-year clock starts from the time you get married.
Nah.
I think probably when you're probably together, maybe. I don't know.
Living Ian, I don't believe in that anyway.
Do you live with her?
We're about to move in together Sunday. But I live 2 blocks away. I mean, I stay.
And you're out of town, what, 80%?
Yeah, which I think actually helps the relationship to be apart a bunch.
I
In the movie Comedian, Jerry Seinfeld says, he's quoting somebody else, but he says, the hardest part about being married is not letting your wife hear you whistle while you're packing your bags.
Oh, that's funny.
Which to me is like a true testament to what makes being a comic and married so great.
Right.
Is the ability to leave, come back, and have things be.
Yeah, I think it's nice. You know, absence makes.
Well, you got, I think, a pretty sweet situation, though.
It has been. It's not as sweet now as it once was because we both traveled a lot. And now she's in one spot. And so when I'm gone, I'm just missing.
Oh.
You know what I mean? So, like, yeah. When you're both traveling.
Right.
It's a different dynamic than when one person's traveling and the other person's not. Because right. Then there's resentment.
Yeah. Yeah, she's pretty laid back and we're cool. I try to take just a day at a time, which sounds so cliche. But, like, it's like... Yeah, it's weird to think about being with the same
person forever.
Is she a professional? Forever.
Like, she have like
oh,
a...
she's a comedian as well, which is also helpful. Comedians... Some people can be like, I never date a comedian, but I'm like, I don't understand dating a
non-comedian.
Right. You gotta have someone that has a passion and understands. And what's also nice about dating a comedian or marrying a comedian is we can be out at a comedy club and we're together. It's not weird. If you bring your fucking whatever...
Yeah.
...girlfriend, she's like, I hate all these people. I don't know who these people are. I don't know what you're talking about.
I don't know if I'm a compartmentalist... But I feel exactly like what you're saying in terms of, like, I don't like to take my wife around my comedy friends.
Right.
Because that's not, like, contextually normal for her. She's a professional. And I bring around these people that I say anything. There's no filters in front of me.
Well, that's what's helpful, too. I mean, a lot of times you bring it. We say cunt like it's, you know, whatever word. I mean, we say cunt so much it's crazy.
Use the proper form of cunt, please.
Cunt and cunty and... Which I think we like forget. You just say I say cunty in front of my mother. I'm like, no.
Ooh,
sorry. Yeah,
sorry about that. But she was acting cunty. You were acting cunty, mother-in-law.
Come in on. A cunt-like way.
But cunty. Yeah, I think it's great and it's easier that way. And I don't know. Yeah.
Who's she? You're more successful than her as a comic.
Yeah, to this point. But she's a woman, so that could change by the time we're done with this conversation.
Change. Just like.
I mean, she might have a movie deal by the time this podcast is over.
That's true. She could definitely... well, so then speak to this for me for a second at least. Working together. You guys work together ever?
On the road a little bit, yeah, here and there.
What's that like?
It's great. I mean, I love it because I can get laid on the road. I mean, that's the best
interesting
part.
Interesting.
But it's hard because... if she gets like heckled, I want to fucking murder the person. I have to worry about two sets now.
Right.
Like if she's not doing right. well, I have to be like, fuck. Yeah, it makes me uncomfortable. And I'm like in the back. Like,
have you
on.
Ever dated a comic before this?
Not really. I dated a comic for like 5 weeks, but
oh,
not really. Brooke Van Poplin.
Oh, yeah.
At that time. Yeah. Very briefly.
I like Brooke.
Have you ever dated a comic?
She's very successful now.
Yeah. I dated a girl for probably 2 years who wasn't really she was a terrible comic. That, I think that's a huge part that he's got. He's got
she's a good
comic. Oh yeah, I couldn't date someone I didn't respect.
Yeah, that's why he can bring her on
my
the road.
Come on, talk is off the
he
chain.
He respects her
comic.
Act. She yeah. is a solid comedian. I dated a girl who was like a dog shit. She was not only a bad comedian, just the unfunniest person.
Mm.
But she was Asian and had a good puss.
Yeah, she
hot.
Was dog shit and she ate dog.
Yeah.
Hello, folks. Hey, Duxton. And by the fact.
Yeah, I never. Towards the end, when we would fight and stuff, I remember saying, like, oh, and by the way, you've never, ever been funny.
Oh, God. Go for the jugular, Jesus. Oh.
Well, I know how much that one hurts me.
I didn't even start comedy until I met my wife. But my wife is the first person I ever said that I wanted to be a comic, too. And she was the first person to ever say, I think you should do that.
Oh, that's nice.
Inside of that, I think I found, like, okay, this is who I'm going to marry, because clearly she's okay with what I want to do. But at the time that I said that...
She had no idea how much work it was going
to
take.
Yeah, and I was so far from... I didn't even know what it meant to say I wanted to be a comedian.
Right.
And the fact that she stuck with it is a huge testament. But at the same time, there's a certain amount of resentment from when I'm loving my job... And she's not, it's a huge disconnect.
Right.
Because she brings, like, so much more money to the table in her profession than, like, I'd have to be 3 times as successful as all 3 of us.
Right.
She's a relief pitcher for the Pirates.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
She's on the practice squad. It's good. It's good money. But what it does for me is it makes me feel in debt.
To her. Yeah.
Is she, because she's floating the main nut?
Well, it's like, without her, my whole lifestyle changes. I'm still a comic, but now I'm living a completely different existence.
Yeah, you'd be like one of the rest of us.
Exactly. Yeah, be like the rest of you guys. Right. The rest of you guys. So
let's put a cap on this thing.
Yeah, let's put a cap on this. Let's end it right here. At what's the end game for Joe List?
Death. I don't know. I have real trouble with long-term goals, and it's been
how
a problem of mine in my career.
Do you have a five-year plan?
No, I have like a one-month plan.
Do you want to be a movie star?
No, I mean, I never thought that way, because I have... I don't have that kind of thought process. I have that fucking New England blue-collar thing where... Or not, it's not even New England. It's America, human thing. I'll be as successful as these people that I have grown up with, and then that'll be that.
Yeah.
Which I'm trying to change and be like, oh, man, I could be way more successful. But I'd like to just perform for a group of people that came to see me. I mean, that's always been my goal.
How much more successful are you currently than you ever thought?
I never thought. That's the problem. I never
thought. So you never even imagined this.
But if someone told me that I would have this bank account that I have right now, I would have been like, that's fucking bananas. Yow! Because I've never had money, so it's crazy to have any amount of money to me.
How many different times have you said, now I'm making money?
I mean, the last few months, maybe, last year, I'm like, okay, this is cool. But I also don't trust it because I grew up, my parents are, you know,
it's only right now that you can, you don't know what's going to happen.
Well, that's the thing, too. I'm a fucking bad tooth away from having 0 months. I don't have insurance.
Yeah,
and
my elbow.
And that's funny. I also only look like I have stuff because I don't own anything.
Right.
Like I have money because I don't have a house or a fucking car or health insurance or anything else.
You haven't had time to.
So, yeah, and I'm not currently sick, so... Yeah, I could be wiped out in a moment. And that's the only thing scary about comedy. I have no work after September.
Right.
It's a fucking... That's where it's a scary business, but...
How much of that... But isn't that the part of the thrill of it?
I don't have that at all. I don't have that mindset. I know a lot of people that do have that, and they love it. I'm not wired that way. I'm a very anxious fucking person. So I'm always scared I'm going to have to, you know, not have money. But... My goal would be to perform for a whole room full of people that came to see me instead of just comedy.
I agree.
And that makes you a rich person monetarily and...
metaphysically,
yeah.
Right?
But I have no desire to have celebrity. I would like to be Brian Regan's level.
That's exactly
which is
what I
said. Every comic I ever
walk across
meet,
the street and nobody knew I was just at the club.
Celebrity seems real sick and unhealthy.
Celebrity is something that I think it's one of those things like being a good parent. You don't really get to say it about yourself. It's one of those things that other people kind of embolden on
you. I don't know. I've heard celebrities refer to themselves as, I'm a celebrity.
It is once you've reached that level, for sure. But
I've heard people say it that aren't even really.
And how sad is that? How sad is that?
When do you work with Ari again?
That's exactly who I'm talking about.
Ari is the one guy that comes out, hangs out with a bunch of fucking people after the show, and then somebody says something to him, and he's like, I don't really want to talk to any of these people. I don't want to talk to you guys. I'm just here. Like, you could have done that inside, away from all of us.
I think everyone has their own weirdness, and he has his. And
what's the end game for Tom Dustin? What's the 5-year plan for Tom Dustin?
This podcast is the end game.
Excellent. I'd like to say that
I'm ending, and I hope it is.
Pete Porielli famously once said, "Between me and Jay Snyder, who may be
he's not famous."
he said. Have you ever met a guy who's just got no ambition?
That's me.
Just happy to be middling? And I was like, this sounds like a guy I know. And then when he said Tom Dustin at the end of that, I was like, what the fuck?
I don't think I have no ambition. I don't have any drive. I don't have any discipline.
You have more humility. You have humility to spare, is what I would say.
I don't know. I don't even know what that really means. Does it mean thank you, good night, podcast over?
No. Well, this is what I want to get to the bottom of. How much of what you want are you actively asking for? Because I feel like Tom.
Well, that's
Dustin,
the thing. I don't even know what I want. I'd like. Here's all. I have it so generalized, just down to this. I'd really like to make more money where I had dental, or I'd really like to make a little more money than I make. I'd like to make double the money that I'm making, and that still would be shit.
But that's a very Boston thing, because I have the same thing. None of us ever thought, like, oh, this is what I want, and this is how I'll do that, which is important in life, which I'm realizing later, to be like, you have to be like, what, you need short-term goals and long-term, which is what Tommy Jonigan was beating into my head for years. I was like, this guy's an idiot. And then he sold his third show and picked me up in his Mercedes. And I was like, all right, well, maybe he's on to something. Right. But and then you have that realization where we're sitting in the green room and I'm like angry at this guy. And I'm like, oh, I'm mad because I want what he wants. Maybe I should start listening to him. But I still have that problem. Would be like, what do you want? I'm like, I don't know. I want to fill my September, which is not a good business model. So I don't know. I got to figure it out.
Have you ever seen the movie Syriana?
We have to figure it out.
Yeah, I did.
There's one line in that movie that I like more than any other line, and it's when the main bad guy is talking to the young Arab prince, and he's trying to make a deal with him because his brother's supposed to be heir to the throne.
I vaguely remember. Yeah,
he's going to angle this guy out of it, and he's asking him like, "Well, what do we got to do to make the deal?" And he's like, "I'm sitting here talking to a boy who doesn't even know how to ask for what he wants."
Uh huh.
And that was important to me because that was before I started doing comedy. And really, like, before I started doing comedy, the end game would just be to start doing comedy.
Right.
But then once you get into comedy, you realize all the layers.
I remember when I first started doing comedy, I did have a goal. And what it was we were doing open mics and stuff, and we were like the new low guys on the totem pole, and I felt really insignificant and shitty. And there was always that group of comics that were kind of good, and they had been around, the veteran guys. Uh-huh. They still weren't famous or anything, you know, but the veteran guys. And at the comedy club we used to do the open mic at, those five or six guys would all sit at a table in the corner, uh-huh. and they'd just laugh and tell stories about gigs. And my goal when I first started doing comedy was just to sit at that table.
I think that's an
And then when I finally got to that table, I was like, where'd all the cool kids go?
You discredited once you got there. So yeah. I think that's the lesson of comedy.
Yeah, I think that, but definitely the thing that, this reminded me of it, is like the key to comedy, I think, and maybe any business, is to figure out what do I want to do in 6 months, 5 years, 10 years, and what am I doing today to help me get there?
Right.
Which I think is, that's when I think people have success. What am I doing to fucking help me get to that?
How much of your sobriety, was your sobriety contingent on like some sort of end goal of that? Or was it just like, I'm not going to survive?
I don't know. My sobriety was just a better quality of life. I wanted to be happy. I was unhappy and truly had a deep hatred for myself that I don't have as much anymore. It's still in there.
It's still in there, but you know, everyone's always fighting that.
Yeah. Every single position I sat in just then, I felt like an asshole. Until I'm sitting like this.
Which is I'm going to say, Joe, is kind of an asshole position.
But, yeah.
Thanks, guys. I really appreciate
it.
Thank you. I got to pee real bad.
Yeah.
Joe, thank you so very much. I appreciate it. That was fun. Podcasts are great because they just end up being a good conversation.
Coming. Mm-hmm.